This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Our first question comes from Dr. Mark Leach, who says, "Hi, I'm a chemist based in Manchester and have been wondering about the density of the universe at the epoch of recombination, about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. Are there any present-day analogies of this temperature and pressure? Thanks, and keep up the good work, Mark."
So the recombination era is a kind of process, or a long period rather than just one. So the temperature varies a little bit throughout that period. But it's about 3,000 or 4,000 Kelvin, so 3,000 or 4,000 centigrade approximately. So that's a kind of easily accessible temperature to experiments today, with lots of things that we can get that kind of temperature with. What's very different about the universe at the era of recombination is the density of the universe. So that's actually incredibly low by the standards of the Earth and everyday experiments. So even though it's huge compared to the density of the universe today, it's about a billion times bigger, it's still tiny compared to what we normally experience. So we have the density of the universe at recombination is about 10 to the minus 18 kilograms per cubic meter. So that's a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a kilogram per cubic meter. So absolutely tiny. So that's why there's not really any easily accessible density that we can sort of probe or experiment with in the modern universe, because that's very close to what we would call a vacuum. What's kind of similar in temperature, oddly enough, is the temperature of the solar photosphere. So the outermost part of the sun has a temperature that's sort of fairly close to the temperature of recombination. And that's not entirely a coincidence, because they're both related to the excitation energy of electrons and protons. So that's not entirely a coincidence. And there's a very interesting paper by Crow, Moss and Scott on April Fool's Day 2008, which the community sort of wondered if it was an April Fool's Day joke, because it was about how the sun was very similar to the universe. But it's a very serious piece of work, actually. So we know that these kind of temperatures and densities are what's around based on how we know the universe has expanded since recombination. So recombination happened at what we call redshift about 1,000, which means the universe was 1,000 cubed times its current three-dimensional size. So 1,000 times smaller in linear scale, so 1,000 cubed times smaller in volume since, compared to the modern day. And that means we know that the density of matter has gone up by a factor of 1,000 cubed. But with temperature, it's a little bit more complicated, because photons behave a bit differently when you kind of scale space, because the photons get stretched themselves, as well as the kind of number of them being stretched. It's a little bit more complicated with the temperature, but the density is a really simple calculation from the modern day.
So John Brooks writes in to ask, "If Stephen Hawking is correct and black holes can evaporate, wouldn't that imply that something, and he's meaning radiation, can escape from a black hole? And if so, why can't we see black holes emitting this radiation?"
So on one level, this is above my pay grade, because it cuts to the heart of the difference between a classical object and a quantum object. So black hole radiation is the place where all the classical ideas we have, so the relativity and the kind of smooth ideas of space-time, butt up against the world of the quantum phenomena, in which things are much more complicated and sort of much harder to reason about in the way we can do in a familiar way. Probably only Stephen Hawking knows the exact answer to that question. But the general picture is, and the easy answer, I suppose, is that actually the stuff we see escaping from black holes isn't actually escaping from inside the black holes. It's escaping from very near the surface of a black hole, so not quite inside. So in that sense, that's kind of a cheat answer to get out of it. But that is true, because the way that this emission happens is that virtual particles appear in pairs, as they do throughout the universe. They're kind of spitting out of the energy of empty space, and one of the particles goes into the black hole and one comes out. So that's the kind of classical picture of what's going on. The real quantum picture is much more complicated, and it's not quite my area of expertise, so I shouldn't go into it too deeply. But the question of can we see the emission is an interesting one. There's no theoretical reason why we can't see an emission like that. We expect the radiation coming from a black hole to be roughly thermal, so that means having the same kind of emission profile as just a warm object. Unfortunately, the expected levels that you get from a kind of reasonably sized black hole are just much too low to be able to see it compared to all the other stuff we can see in space. So if you were close enough to this, you should in theory be able to detect this kind of thing, but in practice, because it's so dim compared to the other sources of light, we just can't see it. The typical wavelengths are supposed to be infrared. It's peaking in the infrared region of the spectrum, just to do with the temperature that you expect a kind of classical-sized black hole to be. If you were close enough and you had the right kind of infrared detector, just like the kind we could get here on Earth, you could in theory see them.
Excellent. Well, maybe one day in the future we'll actually be able to see the surface of a black hole.
I think that's a long way off.
And finally, we've got another question from John Brooks, who asks, "If light, or a photon, has no mass, then how can it be affected by a gravitational field?" And he's thinking namely of gravitational lensing, or black holes.
So there's two ways to answer this question. One classical, that Isaac Newton would have approved of, and one relativistic, that Einstein would have found really exciting. So the classical answer, which is a very reasonable answer, is that that photons obey the same Galilean principle that everything else does. So the Galilean principle is just that things of different weight or different mass drop at the same speed. So if it's the classic idea is holding two different sized balls out of the Leaning Tower of Pisa and dropping them, seeing if they fall at the same speed, and they do. So if two blocks of a reasonable size drop at the same speed, then that's true no matter how small you make one of the weights. So, you know, if a thing, 1 kilogram drops the same speed as a gram, or a milligram, or a microgram, or a nanogram. So no matter how small you go, those two things still drop at the same speed. So the idea is that you just take the kind of limit of that process, which is mass of zero. And so, you know, if something of a millionth of a gram drops at the same speed as a much heavier object, then why not something of mass zero? That's the kind of classical picture that explains that idea. The relativistic picture is much more interesting and much more exciting. The idea there is that it's not that the gravitational field that the Earth or other things are producing, or the black holes or the gravitational lens, the gravitational field that those things are producing is not directly affecting objects like photons or like ordinary matter. What it's doing is bending and curving the space-time that those things are moving through. So the photon and the object see the same kind of space-time as each other, and it's all caused by the mass of the gravitationally lensing object. So the idea is that they're not looking at the object itself, they're looking at the underlying gravitational distortion to the universe, and that's the same no matter what kind of object you are. What is different between photons and massive objects in relativity is how fast they go, which is obviously very reasonable. Ordinary objects go at a very slow speed compared to the speed of light. The idea is that because light is going so fast, it can see different bits of that curvature, namely the curvature of time as well as the curvature of space, that ordinary moving objects just can't see. So actually, when you look at real objects, a slow-moving object bends about half as much by gravity as a photon does. And we've actually, interestingly, although that's been known for a very, very long time, we've only recently been able to detect it in the weak lensing regime, although it was Eddington in 1921 who showed it was true for the strong lensing regime around the sun. So that was the very first proof of relativity, was that difference between the bending of light and the bending of ordinary matter.
Brilliant. Great explanation. Thanks, cool. Joe.
Thanks.
And if you'd like Joe to answer one of your questions, send them in at www.jodcast.net/contact.